LinkedIn News.
From the news team at LinkedIn, I'm Jesse Hempel, and this is Hello Monday. It's our show about the changing nature of work and how it's changing us. It's Earth Day this week, an event that we have been observing for more than half a century now. And in 2024, it's hard to look away from the climate crisis happening all around us. We're seeing and feeling it every single day. The oceans are rising, the winters are warmer, the storms are more severe. Sometimes these problems feel so large and so intractable. It's hard not to ask the question, what can I do? You know, not long ago, I was having dinner with a friend who had just changed jobs. I asked her, what was so wrong with the thing you were doing? It was so cool. You loved it. You were so good at it. She said, you know, I was having so much anxiety about the climate. And one day I decided I just had to work on it every day. I love this story because it wasn't like she had a career as an environmental scientist. She really didn't. But she was able to take her skills and transform them into something that mattered to her and really to all of us a lot. Today, I want to explore how we make these kinds of transitions. It's how I want our show to observe Earth Day. First, we're going to talk to a woman who shifted gears in her early 40s, and then we'll catch up briefly with a friend of mine who works at the Nature Conservancy. He's going to tell us about the growing opportunities he sees in sustainability. I hope there will be a lot in this conversation for you if you're even thinking about making a shift. Stick around.
The LinkedIn Podcast Network is sponsored by TIAA. TIAA makes you a retirement promise, a promise of a guaranteed retirement paycheck for life. Learn more at TIAA.org/promisespayoff.
I first met Fiona Spruill when I was covering technology for Fortune and Wired. She had a really cool career. She'd spent 14 years at the New York Times, but when I caught up with her, she was working at Meetup, where she was in charge of global growth. Meetup is this really cool company that was invented mostly to help people actually meet up off of the internet in real life. There was a sense of mission to this role, and Fiona rose to become the chief operating officer in the 5 years she was there. Then in 2018, the company sold to WeWork. A year later, Fiona realized she was ready to try something new. That's where our conversation starts today. Here's Fiona Spruill.
I had my second baby right before we sold the company. To be totally honest, when I left Meetup, I knew that the thing that I needed to do was to take a break and actually not think about what I was going to do next for a few months. Now, of course, I was very lucky and privileged to be able to do that, but I knew that was the only thing I knew for certain was that I needed a break and kind of a mental refresh. And so I set myself a goal of at the end of the summer to start figuring it out. And that's basically all I knew.
How long was that?
It was about 6 months that I allowed myself to focus on family and kind of regeneration.
I think that that part is so important because for so many people, whatever they're doing, when they are seized with that feeling that they need a shift, they need a change, maybe they know directionally what it is, maybe they don't at all. Usually at that point, they're so absorbed in whatever they're doing and so burnt out and spent by it that you have to build in a period of recovery before you can really plunge into the next thing. But Fiona, usually it makes people really anxious, no matter what the terms are. Were you anxious about it?
Oh, absolutely. There were things that I was completely terrified about. And I think especially, you know, people of my age, you sort of grew up thinking, oh, you can't have a break in your resume. You know, that's going to make it look like something's wrong with you. And I think there's still some of that feeling that a lot of people really worry about. And of course, there's also financial pressures. So absolutely, yeah. I faced all of those fears.
Well, if you don't mind me asking, and you can totally pass on this, but how old were you at that point?
Oh, that's a good question. I need to do the math. 42.
42.
Is that right?
Right.
Yeah, 42.
And you
yeah.
had been working pretty consistently since you finished college, as many, many of us have. And you were living, like many folks who listen to this show, in an urban area where the cost of living is significant. For all of those reasons, it can be challenging to take the break. What happened after 6 months?
Well, there wasn't one specific moment that I can point to, but it was over the summer of 2019 where it just became clear to me that helping to solve our climate crisis in whatever capacity was the thing that I needed to focus on. And so what happened was I came out of that sort of 6 month reset period with this clarity, which was great. But then I still had no idea how to actually get a job and do this. And so that took another period of time.
Well, so Fiona, I feel like many listeners may be able to resonate with that feeling that there's an awakening around how significant the climate crisis is. And, you know, we derive agency from being able to lean in and find something to do. And I feel also like I hear from listeners, one in particular who said, I just wish I had pursued some sort of a technical background. Or I wish that I knew people who worked on those things. I wouldn't even know how to begin. My network is in marketing for consumer package companies. So did you know people who were working on these issues at the time that you decided this is what you wanted to pursue?
Not many. No, I didn't. And that was why I undertook what was in some ways a journalistic kind of expedition to talk to as many people and try to sort of report out what the options were, what the interesting companies were, and figure it out.
Yeah. So how exactly did you go about that?
Well, I just started talking to people. I started talking to smart people in my own network, to former investors in Meetup. And, you know, the more you talk to people, the more someone knew someone who was also interested in this topic. And gradually I got connected to more and more people and started to really feel like I was learning about the climate tech space, which in 2019 was, you know, the revitalization of climate tech from clean tech 1.0 was really just starting to happen.
Yeah. So I don't actually know that much about that revitalization period and what came of it. If for those of us who are really, really new to this, how would you describe that moment?
Well, I'm sure there are people who are better historians of the recent climate tech movement than I am. But there's, you know, there's one person that I would point to who I think is a focal point for it, and that is Jason Jacobs. And he started a community and an investment fund called MCJ, which stands for My Climate Journey. And it was also a podcast. It still is a podcast. And so early on, when I was having those early conversations, I had multiple people say to me, oh, you sound like my friend Jason, who comes from a tech background and is also trying to work on climate. And he has this podcast where he's trying to figure it out. And so I reached out to Jason and was an early member of that community. And ultimately, that's how I found Overstory. And so that was an important moment.
I love that you highlight the way that Jason used a podcast to create the community and essentially draw to him the people interested in the same types of problems he was interested in. And I remember, Fiona, about that time getting an invitation from you to join a newsletter that you created to do something similar, to essentially follow your own curiosity path, right?
Yeah, I was definitely inspired by Jason. I think his podcast has been vastly more successful and more widely listened to than my newsletter that I think only had 3 or 4 editions. But yeah, it was a good framing mechanism for my thoughts. And so yeah, it was a good experiment.
Fiona, you talk about it almost apologetically, and I want to push back here, actually. I don't think that the value of that newsletter, which, yeah, I think it probably had at least four editions that I remember, I don't think the value was in drawing a massive community. I think it seems like the value, and the reason why I would actually suggest anybody attempt something similar, is that it focused you. And it served as a stake in the ground for anyone at that point immediately interested in, well, what's Fiona interested in, right?
I think that's absolutely true. It was, it really helped me focus in on the different areas of the climate crisis, which is unfortunately massive, right? Climate touches everything. And so I was able to focus in on some areas that I was most interested in.
How did you get from the point where you felt like you wanted to put the skills that you had to use in service of improving the climate to the actual entry point to a job in a company that you cared about?
Yeah, it was a meandering journey with ups and downs. But, you know, I give advice to people who are embarking on this journey, which is to be really clear about whether you're in the exploration mode or the find a job mode. And despite the amount of times that I've given that advice, I don't think I was great at following it myself. But once I was clear that I'm in find a job and I was able to articulate that clearly to myself and to others of what I wanted to do, then, you know, things started to fall into place.
I like thinking about it that way, thinking about exploration mode, which is when you're really going out in the world and seeing what's there, and then getting focused and moving to, okay, now we're in find a job mode. If you can remember back, how long did you stay in exploration mode before you flipped that switch?
Well, it was on and off because I did have a couple consulting gigs along the way. And so when I was working with a specific company, then I was focused on that company. But the whole process took almost a year. Now, there was a global pandemic in the middle of it, which kind of, you know, made things a little more challenging. But yeah, this was not a short process. And I know how lucky I am to have been able to take that much time.
We're going to take a quick break here. When we come back, Fiona makes her move to climate work.
The LinkedIn Podcast Network is sponsored by TIAA. In the last 100 years, we've seen financial markets swing, new currencies come and go, decades of savings lost in days, all showing that a retirement plan without a guarantee, quite simply, isn't enough. So more than a retirement plan, TIAA makes you a retirement promise. A promise of a guaranteed retirement paycheck for life. A promise that pays off. Learn more at TIAA.org/promisespayoff.
Hi, I'm Tomer Korn, LinkedIn's Chief Product Officer. On my podcast, Building One, we dive deep into what it takes to build great products. Recently, we had Zach Perret, the CEO of Plaid, and he shared about his struggles building a financial app for consumers and how he was able to turn it all around with a critical pivot. Take a listen.
I personally couldn't resonate as much with the consumer set that we were trying to reach. I just didn't have that level of empathy. When we made the shift to building a B2B product, though, I was building the product that I wanted. My co-founder and I were creating the product that we wanted ourselves, and we had so much empathy for what that product was.
Such a great insight.
You know, in that sense, we got lucky because we were creating a thing for ourselves. And then the people that we were talking to also had the same problems we did. They were fintech developers. We'd been a fintech developer. We'd been trying to build a fintech product for a year. And so we had such deep empathy. We had such a clear ability to...
If you want to hear more of Zach Perret's story and the lessons that follow, listen and subscribe to my podcast, Building One.
And we're back. Fiona's transition required that she get really clear on her values. And it required that she figure out what kinds of roles she wanted to pursue, what sort of company. There were other big questions to sort out too, like, would Fiona's family be willing to pick up and move for the right opportunity? They were up for it, but it all hinged on finding the right next move. And then Fiona learned about a small climate tech startup based in Amsterdam. It's called Overstory. Once again, here's Fiona.
Overstory applies AI to remote sensing data, which is largely, in our case, satellite images, in order to help prevent wildfires and reduce the risk of power outages. So it's a software product that we sell to electric utilities.
Mm-hmm. What made you particularly excited about this challenge?
Yeah, it's a little different than both the New York Times and Meetup, definitely. You know, there are three reasons why Overstory was so appealing to me. The climate mission and the potential climate impact was kind of a non-starter. So I wouldn't have been interested with Overstory if I didn't believe in that. I really liked the founding team, and that was super important for me. Ultimately, it's, you know, it's about the people. And so that was, you know, at the top of my list. I was excited by how different it was from anything that I had done, was really excited about the potential of the technology. And then the last reason was the move to Amsterdam, which was an exciting adventure for my family.
Yeah. So here we are a few years later, reflecting on that transition. Two questions for you. The first is, you joined a company with a very technical mission. Fiona, I think there are so many of us that are really intimidated by a lot of the technology that is really going to help us through the challenges the climate presents. But your career is a testament to the fact that we can come from a non-technical background and have huge impact. How did you think about the technical aspects of the company you were joining as you joined it?
Well, listen, I'm still learning every day, and there's a lot more I need to learn. So no, I don't come from a deeply technical background. I do think my experience at Meetup working, you know, at a tech company and working closely with our chief technology officer there and supporting our data science and machine learning efforts, like I had a deep reverence and appreciation for the craft, even if I don't have a deep technical knowledge in that area myself. I consider myself to be a generalist, and I think it's really important to focus on what you are good at and what you can bring to a team and to a company. And so I was very upfront with the founders of Overstory about what I would be bringing them and what I would not be bringing them. And so that's how I overcame that particular issue.
Mm-hmm. And then as you look back to that transition now, 4 years out, what have you learned after the fact?
Oh my gosh. How long is your podcast? I've learned so many things. I mean, I think for me, the most exciting part of this journey at Overstory has been the stage of the company. So I was, you know, I was employee number 10. We had just raised our pre-seed round. And, you know, just alone, that's very different from Meetup, which was 120 people and Series D when I joined. And I think you know that the New York Times is not exactly an early stage startup. And so I think yeah. just the day in and day out of building a company and one that has people working in 10 different countries, building a product completely from scratch, these are all just amazing learning experiences.
Yeah, totally. Fiona, how do you measure the impact of your work for yourself at this moment in your life? We're in the middle.
Well, I think as a leader, the most important legacy that you leave when you're at a company or when you leave a company is your team. And that's something that I learned at the New York Times, certainly reaffirmed it from the amazing team and culture that was built at Meetup. And what I hope that I'm doing now, that, you know, ultimately it is about the people. From a mission standpoint, my perception and understanding of Overstory's mission and impact has evolved. The reason I joined Overstory, because I was really excited about building a global database relating to trees, where we could use this amazing technology to know the size, location, species, and health of every tree on the planet, and how that was just foundationally important to solving our climate crisis.
Yeah.
And we're still doing that and still building that. But I also see our work as being so much about building a reliable electric grid, which is also just foundationally important to solving and adapting to the climate risks that we're facing now that are not our future problem, but they're a now problem.
That was Fiona Spruill. She is now the CEO of Overstory. Next up, Peter Ellis, the Global Director of Natural Climate Solutions Science at the Nature Conservancy. Peter and I went to college together, and in contrast to Fiona, Peter knew he wanted to become an environmental scientist since he wandered around campus barefoot back in the 90s. Really, I remember, he didn't wear shoes. He's an expert in this area. I really trust him, and I wanted his perspective on where opportunity exists in his field. Here's Peter.
So I work with a team of scientists to help provide tools and information to accelerate the deployment of natural climate solutions. So natural climate solutions are land stewardship activities that increase the amount of carbon on the landscape. So right now, everyone is desperate to identify that technology that can suck carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and store it in a durable space. The truth is that technology was invented 3 billion years ago, and it's called a plant. So the idea of natural climate solutions is to work with that technology, to work together with nature, to help deliver measurable climate mitigation in the face of the single greatest crisis that civilization has ever faced.
It's no exaggeration to say that there has been a mainstream awakening to this crisis over the course of Peter's career. But as he put it in our conversation, that awakening can also make people feel apathetic and powerless.
I mean, I can understand where the powerlessness comes from. I think the sort of generation we grew up in is like, turn off the lights behind you and recycle. And, you know, those are the ways you can be an environmental activist. And those are good things. They are good things that you can do, but they're not enough. And our kids' generation now gets it that it's not just about your personal decisions, but it's about how you engage in your everyday activities and what you decide to commit yourself to. It's how you vote. It's how you buy things. It's how you get out there on the street and actually protest things. It's about who you decide you want to have conversations with, what type of conversations you have. They get that in a way I don't think we did. Environmentalism and the climate challenge is not something constrained to a special interest. It pervades every part of our lives, and it will continue to do so even more.
Now, if you're saying to yourself, I want to do climate work, but I don't have a technical background, I'm not a scientist, well, Peter would like you to rethink that position.
I would say, like, that's what's so awesome about the climate challenge is we need all kinds of skill sets. We need engineers. We need teachers. We need media professionals. Everybody has a role to play in helping to build the collective action necessary to actually face this crisis. And so I'm biased because as a scientist who works on climate, I hope that there is some base level of knowledge that everyone should be able to gain to help understand how to use their own skill sets effectively. But that is not an insurmountable amount of information for anyone. And there are some simple things you can know that help you engage in the activities in a way that meets your own interests and skill sets.
And I'm curious what advice you might have for people who are perhaps in the same space. You know, they've identified, gosh, this is the thing I want to work on, but they don't know what the thing is or even where to begin to ask the right questions to identify the problems.
Yeah. Yeah. I think a lot of the times it's right under your nose. So I think just reasking yourself, what is it about what I'm already doing that can help us work together on transitioning to renewable energy, for example, or speaking to my area, help change farming practices so that they can be more climate smart, or protect wetlands in your backyard so they can store more carbon in soils. Like, it's almost like inescapable. Like, there's so many different places. You can flip it on your head. Like, there are so much you can do if you just start looking.
For people who are unfamiliar with the space, there is so much information coming at you, and it's important to vet the information and figure out, well, where are the right places to look, right? Like, what should I read if I'm only going to read one thing? What should I watch? Who should I listen to? And I'm just curious if you might have something that you might suggest we look at and can trust.
As a scientist, I do believe in the value of peer review literature. There is a lot of noise out there, and if you take a specific interest in a sector, in a topic, delving into the peer review literature is really useful because you usually get straight answers. Because when people publish an article in the peer review literature, they know that all of their colleagues are watching them, and they know that they're going to actually have to go through a gauntlet of having their close colleagues check their own work. For me as a scientist, it's always about transparency, showing your work, and making sure somebody else checks your work. You know, as much as I was being hopeful a moment ago about there are things you can do, there are certainly things we can do that are wrong, and we need to make sure we have the right information to make smart decisions effectively. I can give you some examples if you want, but...
Yeah, give me an example.
So interestingly enough, we just published a paper a week and a half ago on albedo. So albedo is the surface reflectance of vegetation. So in general, you protect a forest or some place with dense vegetation on Earth, it's good because it stores carbon. Trees are half carbon, right? So if you protect a tree, half of the weight of that tree is carbon that will stay out of the atmosphere and therefore help mitigate climate change. The problem is certain types of trees actually either reflect or absorb solar radiation depending on their color. And so that's what the albedo is. So as we change vegetation cover from having trees on it to not, in some places, for example, boreal forests that have dark vegetation that absorb radiation, and then underneath there's snow that reflects it, it actually is less effective than you might think to store carbon in that tree because there is a countervailing effect of the stored radiation that occurs as a result of albedo. This is something scientists have known about for a long time, but we haven't until this paper had the ability to quantify it. So you need to actually make sure you account for that carefully if you're going to decide which places on Earth you want to protect from deforestation or reforest, to account for that albedo effect. So this is an example of, like, do your homework, make sure people are including all the variables in making decisions. And we're putting that information up into a website called NatureBase that allows people to have all of that background information for you already evaluated, so you don't need to worry about the guts of it, but it's there.
So NatureBase becomes a trusted place where I know that information is vetted and I could go there and can then trace back to the original sourcing.
Exactly.
But for now, I do want to come back to this, like, this call to action, really, for our listeners, which is to say, like, there's an opportunity there, right?
Yeah. In regards to natural climate solutions, I do think there is a huge call to action. First of all, I think there is no excuse for cutting down tropical forests. We need to start with that. That is the biggest thing that is easy, low-hanging fruit. And we can feed the world's growing population. There's research to show that we don't need to keep cutting down tropical forests. We've already cut down more or less half of them. We need the remaining forests there.
Yeah.
And so people, like, you want something to get worked up about, this is a no-brainer, like biodiversity, carbon, human well-being, resources for indigenous peoples and local communities. It's unfortunate that there's some controversy that's revolved around it because this is a very easy thing to fight for. Let's make sure we protect the remaining dense tropical forests on Earth because they're incredible climate superpowers. Like nature is offering us a huge gift to be able to fight this problem that we've created ourselves by spewing, you know, fossil fuels in the atmosphere. Like, let's not wound ourselves by continuing to do that. That's a very actionable near-term thing. And then there are all kinds of other interesting things you can layer on top of that. Let's make sure we harvest trees more sustainably with lower impact when we decide we need wood products, which we're going to need more of because cement and steel are high carbon footprint, so you need more wood products. But we can do that by, if we do it smartly, let's change our farming practices so we store more carbon in soils. These are all different ways to get engaged, from your own backyard garden all the way through to your pocketbook and your vote.
That was Peter Ellis, Global Director of Natural Climate Solutions Science at the Nature Conservancy. Check out the very cool database that he's worked on, naturebase.org. Lots to learn from this episode. First, if you want to work on climate change, there's so much room for you. This is true whether you are in the middle of your career and thinking about shaking it up, or whether you're just getting started. And there's a great starting place to look for what you can do to make a career in sustainability work. What you're doing right now. What skills do you use in your work today that might play out in the climate space? I bet the answers are broader than you think. Fiona shares some great strategies for becoming smarter about opportunities through networking. And Peter reminds us that if you're just starting to look for information on the climate crisis, look to peer-reviewed papers. This means the things you read or hear will have been rigorously reviewed by scientists and fact-checkers. It's information you can trust. And finally, even if you don't feel like a career in climate work is the path for you, you can still have a positive effect on the environment. How you live, how you spend, and how you vote are all things that can and do impact our climate. We'll be talking about all of this in our group this week, and you can find us, just search for the Hello Monday group on LinkedIn, or go to my profile. You can always find it there. Hello Monday is a production of LinkedIn News. Sarah Storm produced this episode with help from Lolia Briggs. It's sound designed and engineered by Asaf Gaudron. Our theme music was composed just for us by the mysterious Breakmaster Cylinder. Michaela Greer helps us build a better tomorrow every week. Enrique Montavo is our executive producer. Dave Pond is head of news production. Courtney Coop is head of original programming. Dan Roth is the editor-in-chief of LinkedIn. I'm Jesse Hempel. We'll be back next Monday. Thanks for listening.